From a deep, unlit world of silts and crushed bones, there came a stirring, a sudden billowing of dark clouds, and from this maelstrom, names. A torrent, a conflagration.
Seden Sa, Lord Protector of Semai, Haravasan of the River People, Yesendra, the Mountain of Eyes, Woman of Sky above the arrested Hidan, Blessed Hela, Twin Horns of the Elananas, Horastal Ne'eru, Sunbearer and Giver of Crops in the Valley of the Sanathal, Itkovas, Lord of Terror among the Kolas Kachain Chemal of Ethila's Nest.
And the names rose unending, flowing through Bryce Bedick's mind, one after another.
Tra-Thalor of the Twin Rivers, Sower of Spring among the Gralan, Adast, Face of the Moon among the Corson.
All the forgotten gods, and as each name whispered out, sweeping into the torrid current of the Forkrel Asael's warren, his terrible power of the voice, of words and all their magic, Bryce felt part of himself tearing away, snatched loose, drowned in the swirling flow. There was no stopping this. The Pure had found him in the manner that Bryce had desired. As he rode to the forefront of his army, as he fought between two Kachain Chemal, as he delivered unopposable slaughter,
"Find me," he had prayed. "Find me. I am waiting for you. Find me."
Once begun, once the warren was a torrent between the Asael and the prince, there was no stopping it. Power fed power, and its fuel was justice.
Let them be known, all the forgotten gods, all their forgotten people, all the ages past, all the mysteries lost. This unending stream of rise and fall, dream and despair, love and surrender. They deserve utterance one more time, one last time. Take them, take me, you with your power in words, me with my power in names. Without me, your words are nothing. Come, let us devour each other.
He could see the Pure now with a sudden clarity. A tall, ancient male, one arm outthrust, one finger pointing across at Bryce. But the Asael was motionless, frozen in place. No, Bryce's eyes narrowed. He was crumbling. His face was a stretched mask, thin over the bizarre skeletal structure underneath. His eyes wept red. His mouth was open, pulling taut as the jaw angled down, as if the names were pouring down the Pure's throat, as if he was drowning in their deluge. Bryce's own soul was shredding apart. The world, this valley, this battle, all fell away. He could feel the pressure of the sea now, could feel his legs planted in shin-deep mud, and the current rushed past him, scouring the flesh from the bones of his soul, and still he had more to give. Clouds of silt billowed and seethed around him. He was losing his vision. Something was blinding his soul, something new, unexpected.
No matter, I am almost done with him. No, the names do not cease. They can never cease, and once my voice is gone, there will be another. Some day, to guard what would otherwise be forever lost. For you, Forkrel Asael, I have held back on one final name, the one to gather up your own life and carry it into the darkness. This is the name of your god, Forkrel Asael. You thought it a name forgotten, but I remember them all.
Blinded, deafened by some unknown roar, feeling the last of his soul ripping free, Bryce Bedick smiled and spoke then the last name, the name of the slain god of the Forkrel Asael. He heard the Pure's shriek as the power of the name reached out, clutched him tight. For this one god, alone among them all, did not come bereft of its people. This god flowed into the soul of its own child. It does not do to abandon one's own gods, for when they return, so unexpected, they are most vengeful. The current pulled him from the silts, drove him forward into a darkness so complete, so absolute, that he knew it to be the abyss itself. I have saved my people, my dear soldiers. Let them fight on. Let them take breath in owning and in release, in all the measures of living. I have done as a prince should do. Tehol, be proud of me. Aranikt, do not curse me. The sorrow of the ages closed around him. This was one river from which there could be no escape. Do not grieve. We all must come to this place. My friends, it is time to leave. Impossibly, he felt hands close from behind, hard as iron over his shoulders, and a harsh voice hissed in his ear, Not so fast! Faint stood close to Aranikt. The Atreseda was standing, head bowed, her arms out thrust, but her hands and forearms had vanished inside a billowing grey-brown cloud, and water was streaming down from her elbows. The air around her was rank, thick with the decay of tidal flats. Faint could see the veins standing out on Aranikt's taut neck, could see the muscles of her shoulders straining, and the Atreseda was slowly being pulled forward. Whatever was inside that swirling cloud was seeking to drag her into its maw. Off to one side, Precious Thimble was on her knees, shrieking without surcease. They had seen Bryce Bedict there atop the first earthen embankment. They had seen the standing stones rise from the ground around him, pushing upward through dirt and rocks, almost black with slime and filth. They had seen the prince's armor and clothing disintegrating, and then on the man's pallid skin, dark swarms, tattoos, runes, emerging only to be torn free, spinning wild around him, and then rushing across, hammering into the Forkrull Assail. And then, as if within a whirlwind, Bryce Bedict vanished inside swirling gloom that was so thick as to be impenetrable. It spread out, devouring the huge menhirs. Aranikt now began howling. She was being pulled forward, and Faint suddenly understood.
She has him. She has hold of the prince. Gods below!
Faint staggered towards the Atreseda, but something resisted with devastating pressure, bitter cold, and she was flung back, gasping, spitting out blood. On her hands and knees, she lifted her head and looked across. Most of Aranikt's arms had disappeared inside the cloud, and now Faint could make out words in the Atreseda's cries.
Mael! Damn you! Help me!
Faint crawled over to Precious Thimble.
Stop that screaming, witch! Look at me! No, here, look at me!
But the eyes that fixed on Faint belonged to a mad woman.
I can't help her! Can't you see that? She's gone too far, too deep! How is she even alive? It's impossible!
Precious Thimble pulled away, scrabbling like a crab.
He's lost! He's forever lost!
Faint stared at the witch as the words slowly sank deep.
But that's not fair! Not a love like that! No! You can't take it away! Don't you dare kill it! Precious, what can I do? To help? Tell me! Nothing! Go to Hood, then!
She spun round, drawing a dagger.
Mael's an elder god, but Aranikt must understand this. He cannot answer this prayer, not the way it is now. I won't stand here to see this love die. I won't.
The blade cut a glistening slash along her left arm, and then, fumbling to take the knife in her left hand, she carved deep diagonally across her right forearm. Forcing herself forward, she reached for Aranikt.
Mael, take my blood in offering. Just fucking take it.
The pressure sought to rebuff her, but she pushed harder, and then she was through, floundering, unable to breathe, the cold crushing her. She saw her blood billowing out as if underwater, saw it spin on currents, so much of it, she almost lost sight of Aranikt. Desperate, feeling her bones cracking, Faint pushed closer, reached out and took the Atreseda into an embrace.
Male, don't you dare! Don't you dare tell me this is not enough!
Precious Thimble had stared, disbelieving, as Faint struggled to reach Aranict. Her blood was a thick, billowing cloud streaming out from her, curling round to whirl into the dark cloud. There seemed to be no end to it. Someone had taken hold of the witch, strong arms closing round her, lifting her from the ground. Twisting now, she looked up. Ambi Bowles' face was almost unrecognizable.
"This is bad magic," he said.
"Save Faint! Save her!"
But the man shook his head.
"No one can live in there.
Save her, Ambi! For my love, save her!"
His frown deepened, his eyelids suddenly fluttering, and he met her eyes.
"What?
You want me? I'm yours, damn you! Just save Faint!"
Bowl threw her down, her visage darkening.
"All the fun ended with you. I don't want you, witch. I don't ever want to see you again."
Precious stared up at him, and then she snarled,
"I will chase you, Ambi. I'll hunt you down no matter where you go. Year after year I will follow you, I swear it. There's nowhere you can run to, you understand me? Nowhere. I hate you. The only place you could hope to escape me is there."
And she pointed at that billowing cloud of blood now obscuring Faint and Aranict. Ambi made an animal cry, spun and ran heavy-footed straight into the crimson cloud. Precious Thimble fell back.
"Gods below, but that man is stupid."
"Hold on, my love," whispered a voice close to Faint's ear. "Some laws even an elder god cannot easily defy, but he's trying."
Faint felt the life leaving her. She was lying against the legs of Aranict. She could feel them cold as bars of ice. Were her eyes open? All she could see was the redness of her own blood.
"Sweetest, is that you?"
"Always knew you had a romantic streak. What a thing to do."
"I'm dying."
"Looks like it. Regretting your moment of madness?"
Faint shook her head, or tried to.
"Only if it fails."
"Well, how often do we regret successes?"
"Is it enough, sweetie? It's all I have."
"You're in water, fool. Of course it looks like a lot. And if you stay in here any longer, you'll bleed out for sure." "Now, wish I could help you. Wish I could help both of you. But I'm just a ghost. Well, not even that. Could be I'm just a voice in your head, Faint, born out of some bizarre misguided guilt."
"Oh, thanks for that."
A foot slammed into the side of her head, half stunning her, and she struggled feebly as hands groped across her body, briefly closing on one of her tits before moving on, and then back again for a second squeeze. Abruptly, someone was lifting her from the muddy silts, throwing her over one bony shoulder. She felt one hand clutch and then leave her thigh, felt the fingers brush her knee as the arm reached out. A deep grunt seemed to thrum through Faint, and she felt the stranger's feet slip suddenly, as if pulled by some inexorable pressure. And then the heels planted firm, and, impossibly, she felt him heave back against the current. One step, and then another. Another. Ambi Bowl reappeared from the crimson cloud, Faint hanging limp over one shoulder. His other arm was stretched back behind him, and Precious saw him strain, saw him leaning hard, and then out from the cloud emerged Aranict, held by the back of her collar, and after her, the naked form of Bryce Bedict. The cloud erupted, burst apart in a welter of icy water. The four figures fell to the ground, Faint rolling out almost to the witch's knees. Precious Thimble stared down, saw the blood still pumping from the woman's slashed arms. She closed trembling hands on both wrists, healing spells tumbling out on her breath. Soldiers were rushing up, shouts filled the air. Precious Thimble's hands tightened on the wounds, but now there were only scars beneath her palms, and she could feel Faint's pulse.
"But, gods, it's there. I can feel it. It's Faint."
A sudden giggle escaped her, but that was just relief. She'd always hated puns. Proper women did. She scowled down at the scars.
"Hold on. Where did I get that power?
Looking up, she saw Ambi Bol lying motionless on the muddy ground. Beyond him, soldiers crowded round Aranikt, who knelt with her prince, cradling his head on her lap. And then Precious Thimble caught a glimpse of motion from one of Bryce's hands, out from under the cloak someone had thrown over him.
I can't believe it.
Faint stirred, groaned, eyes opening, stared unseeing for a moment, and then focused on the witch. She slowly frowned.
I'm not dead? No, I've just healed you. The Atricida made it out too. So did the prince. Your blood bought passage. Though how that watery piss you call blood ever passed muster in the eyes of an elder god, I'll never know. What? But how? Who saved us? Who dragged us free?
Sudden coughing from where Ambi Bol lay sprawled. Precious Thimble shook her head.
The only one who could faint. Some idiot from Black Dog Swamp.
The dozen menhirs erupting from the earthworks around Prince Bryce Bedict had ruptured the embankment for 60 paces, driving fighting soldiers from their feet, bodies tumbling into the trenches even as enormous mounds of earth and stones poured down, burying scores alive. The Vagath beneath Grub elected to escape the chaos by leaping forward across the entire trench and landed close to where the Fokral Asael stood. The Kachain Chemal had shattered its halberd some time earlier, and now wielded a double-bladed axe in one hand and a falchion in the other. The Fokral Asael stood with his face stretched as if in agony, tilted back, the eyes shut and the mouth stretched wide open. When the Vagath advanced, he gave no sign of awareness. Two swift, thumping strides and the falchion swung down, taking the motionless pure between his right shoulder and neck. The blade tore down through the chest, ripped free in a spray of bone shards. The other Vagath had followed its kin and now came in from the left. An instant after the first Vagath's attack, its heavy single-bladed axe slammed into the side of the Asael's head in an explosion of skull fragments and gore. The Fokral Asael collapsed in red ruin. Even as Grub struggled to wheel the beast round, two heavy quarrels hissed across between him and the Vagath's head and punched into the side of the other Vagath. The impact staggered the giant reptile, and then it fell over, hind legs scything the air.
Back! Back across!
The Kachain Chemal burst into motion, sprinting down the length of the berm, 15-20 paces, and then wheeling to plunge down amidst crowds of Colansi in the first trench. Weapons hammered down, slashed and chopped a carnage-strewn path through to the other side. Pike blades glanced across the armor encasing Grub's legs and girdling his hips, and then they were clawing up the other side, winning free atop what remained of the first bank. Grub looked round for the prince, for any officer, but the chaos reigned on all sides. Had Bryce fallen? There was no way of knowing. But Grub now saw leathery soldiers lifting their heads, saw them tracking his thumping trek across the front of the warring forces, watching the Vagath clear attackers from its path with devastating sweeps of its bladed weapons.
They're looking to me, but I know nothing. Fool, nothing but a life of war. Look well, decide what must be done.
Twisting in the saddle, he scanned the climbing slope to his left, squinted at the succession of fortified tiers, and saw soldiers streaming from the highest positions. But between them and the lethary,
four trenches? No, this is impossible. We've lost a third of the army against this first trench alone.
Grub faced the lethary ranks once more.
Withdraw! He shouted. By the prince's command, withdraw!
And he saw, all along the front, the leathery soldiers disengaging, shields up as they backed away, others dragging wounded comrades with them. Another quarrel hissed past, too close. Cursing, Grub kicked at the sides of the Vagath.
Down from the ridge, along the front! Put those weapons away and find us some shields! Better yet, pick up some of the wounded, as many as you can carry!
The beast skidded down the slope, righted itself, and staying low beneath the cover of the first berm, began picking its way through heaps of bodies. Grubb stared down at the terrible carnage.
I remember on the wall, and that man and all the ones who fell around him. He fought and fought until they overcame him, brought him down. And then there was a cross, and he was nailed to it, and the crows spun and screamed and fell from the sky. I remember the old man on his horse reaching down to collect me up, and the way he wheeled outside the gate to stare back, as if he could see all the way we'd come, the bloody road where I was born, where I came alive. I remember that world. I remember no other. All of the brave soldiers, I am yours. I was always yours.
The Colansey counterattack from troops stationed in the next two trenches met the advance of Safi and Evertine legionnaires in an avalanche of iron fury. Rolling downward the slope, along the wide descent tracks or up and over the berms, they slammed into the Balkando forces like a storm of studded fists. For all the wild fury of the Safi, they were not sufficiently armoured against heavy infantry, and the Evertine soldiers were unable to close a solid shield wall with the Safi in their midst. The first lines were overwhelmed, driven underfoot, and the entire Balkando front reeled back, yielding once more the second berm, and then the first trench, and finally the first bank of earthworks. With the enemy gaining momentum, the legion was pushed back still further. Almost none of the Safi remained by this time, and as the Colansey rolled out onto level ground, they rushed across, only to collide with the legionnaires. They met a solid shield wall. The impact sent bodies and weapons into the air, and the crush made both sides recoil before closing once more in savage fighting. Queen Abrastel, still mounted, her sword and forearm painted with blood, forced her charger away from the inside edge of the Evertine line. The animal's muzzle was gushing blood from a frenzied bite against a visored face, and its hind flanks were slashed through the cladding, spattering blood with every muscle surge. But she could feel the pounding of its heart, and she knew that her horse had never felt more alive than at this moment. It was impossible for her not to grin at the terrible joy in the beast she rode, impossible to not find herself sharing it. Still, they'd arrived upon the crux, and looking to the west, she saw the Lethary forces withdrawing from the assault, though their onager salvos continued unabated. The Pure had done as she had expected, seeking to break her hold here, forcing the Lethary away from any hope of marching to the spire by blocking the valley, but only if they could succeed in turning the Evertine legion. She rode hard round to the back of her legion. Still held in reserve, the Bargast ranks were readying weapons, and Abrastel caught sight of Warchief Spax standing atop a small hill of bundled supplies and straining to see over the Evertine ranks to the front of the battle. She saw him turn to her upon hearing her horse's drumming hoofbeats. She reined in before him.
I've never swum in a sea of blood before, Firehow. How was it?
The queen glanced down to see herself lathered in gore. She shook her sword clear.
How fast were those perish moving? She asked.
A good clip, almost as quickly as a band of white faces on the raid. If they have anything left after tackling the valley side, they should be almost in position. But, Highness, you've seen how many are headed their way.
He shook his head.
Can they even slow them down?
The war chief shrugged.
Depends on the lay of the land, I suppose. If it's a broad front they need to hold, no, they'll barely slow 'em.
Abrastel cursed under her breath as she swung her mount round. Thought furiously for a moment and then nodded.
Very well. Warchief, take your warriors and the Teblor and move with all haste to support the perish. Whatever you can manage, understood?
You send us to our deaths, Highness.
Aye.
She bared her teeth at him.
I show you my coin. You show me your love.
I wasn't complaining, just saying.
We will screen you here.
Highness, you can't hold against this counterattack. We can see that.
We will screen you for as long as is needed, Abrastel said firmly. Now get going, Warchief.
If we do not meet again, Firehair, I should tell you.
and Spax leapt down from the mound of supplies. I went and knocked up your daughter. Gods below! You'll have years of doting on that little runt. You'll know it for mine, 'cause it's got my eyes. Just get going for errant's sake! Laughing, Spax raised his axe and waved it in a circle over his head. As one, the white faces lunged into motion, eastward. Impressed in spite of herself, Abrastel watched in silence for a moment. Spax was following her gaze.
Aye, we live for this, Fireherr. We'll give a good account of ourselves, I promise you.
He looked up at her.
Sing songs about us, and remember to tell your court poets that's Gilk with one K.
She frowned down at him.
How else would it be, you fool? Fare you well, my queen,
Spax said, bowing even as he turned away. When he trotted a dozen paces, Abrastel called out,
Spax?
The war chief glanced back.
Boy or girl, I'll make sure it's named after you, but that's the only favor you'll get.
Smiling, the Barghast waved his weapon, and then was on his way again. She watched the Teblor falling in alongside the mass of white faces, and then she swung round to study her legion. Sure enough, they were being driven back. These Colansi heavies were anything but soft. Abrastel adjusted her grip on the sword in her hand, collected the reins once more.
Let us make them remember us.
She was about to kick her horse forward when a rider thundered up on her left.
Highness!
Abrastel stared. A damned Lethary.
That was a long ride. What news?
The messenger, a blue rose lancer, saluted.
Felicitations from the Prince, Highness.
Felicitations? Gods take me. Sorry, go on.
Highness, the pure Forkrell Asael is dead. Only mixed blood Asael remain in command. The Prince hereby informs you that he has disengaged his forces from the Colansi positions, and that he has established dug-in defences along the Onager line on the valley floor, and will commit a third of his remaining forces there.
Excuse me, a third? The Lethary nodded.
Prince begs to inform you, Highness, that he is on his way to your position.
Abrastel looked round and then cursed. Take a moment to rest your horse, sir, and then ride with all haste back to Prince Bryce. Inform him he'd better hurry. But the messenger wasn't interested in resting, and he wheeled his weary horse round and set out at the gallop.
Damn, but those lancers know how to ride. And damn me, young man, if we both survive this, I'm going to give you a ride you'll never forget.
Abrastel sighed and then shook herself. With a low growl, she kicked her horse forward.
My standard to the front! Get on with you! Follow your damned queen!
Someone had found clothing and armor for the prince. With Erenicht close by his side, he stood on the high ground and watched his troops swarming to entrench all along the line of onagers. Lines of soldiers were moving the wounded back on stretchers, while still others retrieved serviceable weapons from the field, and overseeing it all, a young man riding a Kachane Chimal. Bryce was still struggling to regain himself. He did not know how Erenicht had managed to save him, or how she even survived her descent into that lifeless warren. While still only half conscious, he had heard fragments of conversation, and it seemed that the three foreigners, Faint, Precious Thimble, and Ambi Bole, had all had a hand in his resurrection, and then he'd caught the name Mael.
Old man, we owe you so much. Why are we Bedict so important to you?
But it wasn't me you did this for, was it? It was for Tehol, your chosen mortal, the one you would have wanted as your own son. Rest assured, I'm not complaining.
Someone brought him a helm, and he took it with a grateful nod, tugged it on and fastened the clasp. An officer crowded close.
Sir, we have found you a horse. It would do the troops good to see you again as soon as possible.
Bryce shook his head.
Our Malazan guest has things well in hand, Lieutenant.
He has issued orders in the Prince's name, sir.
A clever thing to do under the circumstances.
He may be young, but he does command a presence on the back of that lizard. From this moment forward, he is to be considered my second. Make this clear to all the other officers.
Yes, sir.
Bryce glanced over to see that a horse had been brought forward. Aronnax spoke.
Still, beloved, it would be good for them to see you.
I am tempted to place Grubb in command of our relieving force, he replied. When she stepped closer, he held up a hand. I am not recovered. I feel as likely to fall off that horse as stay on it. Oh, I'll mount up, and as long as the beast isn't moving under me, why, I should cut a strikingly inspiring figure. He shot a look up at the Imperial Standard and winced. So long as no one looks too carefully. He reached out and took hold of her hand. Aranicht, I am glad you fought for me.
It was mail, she said, and faint's blood. And then, if not for Ambi Bole, we still would have failed.
Will you think less of me if I choose to remain here, commanding these defences?
Bryce, if I had to, I'd have tied you down to keep you here, close to me. We're not saving you just to see you fall to some errant arrow. No, you stay back, issue orders, and leave the rest to everyone else.
He smiled. You have begun to show a stubborn side, Atreseda.
Idiot.
She lit a stick of rust leaf.
The only thing just begun is you noticing it. But that's what makes the first flush of love so dangerous. And once it fades and you start seeing clearly again, why, it's too late.
Still smiling, he took the reins and set a foot in the stirrup, pulling himself up to slump in the saddle with a low groan. From all sides, voices rose upon seeing him. Grimacing, Bryce straightened and then raised one gauntleted hand. The roar redoubled in its intensity. He saw Grubb riding up the slope towards him. The boy didn't look much like a boy any longer. He was splashed with drying blood, and from somewhere he'd found a blue rose lance, and its iron point had swum in blood not long past.
Prince Bryce, I didn't know you. I mean...
There is little time to waste, Bryce cut in. I am placing you in command of the relief force. They're almost assembled. In fact, he squinted eastward, they can shake themselves out on the march. The Volcando are losing ground. Lead them, Commander, and be quick about it. Grubb saluted.
Sir, when we close, I may ride ahead.
Would any of us expect otherwise? Bryce asked.
Just don't get yourself killed.
Nodding, the Malazan youth kicked at the flanks of the Vegas, and the huge beast wheeled round and set off. Faint studied the defenders opposite, watching as they regrouped, drawing reinforcements down from the higher earthworks.
They're going to break cover, she muttered. They're going to charge us.
Precious Thimble glanced over.
What? Why would they do that?
Because most of us are headed east, down the valley. They can't let us chase after their own relieving force. They need to wipe out both the Lethary and the Volcando.
The witch's gaze was darting back and forth along the hasty defences thrown up by the Lethary.
We're badly outnumbered.
Haven't you been paying attention? Assaulting costs dear. We're about to turn the tables on them, and they're not going to like it.
It's only the mixed bloods who are keeping them fighting at all,
Precious said under her breath.
What? What did you say?
It's the mixed bloods feeding off this cursed warren, using it to bend the Khaleesi to their will. I doubt they'd fight this hard without it.
Now you say all this!
Faint looked about, saw the prince sitting on a horse 20 paces away, his back to them as he observed the departing companies. Stepping forward, Faint stumbled slightly, recovered, but her head was spinning.
What's wrong with me?
Blood loss,
snapped Precious Thimble. Hissing in frustration, Faint made her way, slowly, towards Bryce Bedict.
Find the damned mixed bloods. Aim a few onagers at them. Tear them to pieces, and this battle is done.
Prince Bryce!
The man turned his head. Faint hobbled forward.
A word with you, Highness!
Ascending a valley side at the run and in full armour left the parish staggering once they'd reached the top.
Heart hammering in the cage of his chest, Sindacan pulled clear of the others and then halted, studying the lay of the land.
Shit! It's all shit!
40 paces away was a raised road running parallel with the valley, its steep side facing them banked with water-worn stones. In between was a strip of furrowed field left fallow for 2 years or more. Off to the right, 100 paces along, rose a cluster of buildings, farmstead facing onto the field, public stables and inn facing the road. Sindacan continued on, bleakly eyeing the sharp slope of the roadside. Reaching it, he sheathed his sword and scrambled his way to the top. Beyond the road, the unplanted fields stretched on for at least a third of a league, broken up by walled hedgerows forming a chaotic patchwork.
"Now that's better," he grunted.
No army would be happy crossing that. The walls alone would slow them up, since they were as high as a man was tall. The parish could break up into half cohorts and contest one after another, and by the time the Colansi won through, the battle at the spire would be long over.
"Still leaves the road and this side, though. Narrow enough, but where do I wait my defense, road or field? And what about this infernal stony bank? Can't defend it worth a damn. That said, trying to breach along it would be a nightmare until they won through. So I throw a cohort 5 steps back of the line waiting for them. We bottle them up, don't let them spill out to the sides. It'll work. It'll have to."
Hands on his hips, he turned round, looked down on his grey helms. Winded, most of them bent over or on one knee, gulping air like beached carp. He pointed at the buildings.
"Wounded, go there. Cutters on your way. Set up fast as you can. Rest of you, drink down the last of your water if you haven't already. Chew on some food while you're at it. We're going to hold on the road and this side of it, mostly. I want 2 cohorts on the other side in case they send anyone that way. If they do, make them pay, brothers and sisters. Now, march to 20 paces from the buildings and form up there."
Not a single groan as the parish picked themselves up again and set off along the rippled, weed-knotted field. Swinging round, Sindacan looked up the road. Was that a glitter of pike points? He glared back at his grey helms.
"Step lively! Enemy sighted on the road! Wolves preserve us this day."
High-watered Festian gestured, watched as the columns plunged down off the road on the inland side, breaking up as they entered the hedgerow fields. He saw crews rushing ahead with picks to ensure that the passage gates through the walls were serviceable. 700 paces up the road, he could see the cursed parish, but they had fully discounted the enclosed fields. Festian intended to lock fiercely with the grey helms, pushing forward with the weight of 15,000 Colansi heavy infantry, and then send 8,000 through the enclosures to take the road behind them. They would first crush the defenders on the road itself, and then drive the rest south across the field to the very edge of the valley, where the only retreat was a deadly tumble down the steep valley side. He intended to make quick work of this. In the distance to the east, he could make out the top third of the spire. Everything below that, on the ridge descent of the isthmus, was obscured in clouds of dust or smoke. The sight chilled him.
"And now Brother Diligence is dead, slain by some foul trap of sorcery. It all falls to you, Sister Reverence. But we shall prevail. Justice is a sword without equal. I pray to you, sister, hold on. We are coming."
Gilimada slowed her pace to match that of the war chief, and he glared up at the huge woman as he struggled for breath.
"I sent a scout up to the road. There are soldiers on it."
Spax nodded, but could manage little more. He couldn't remember the last time he'd led a raid. And while his warriors were thumping along in his wake with all the infernal ease of youth, his own legs were cramping. There was a stitch in his side, and sweat was stinging the vicious bite Abrastel's daughter had delivered to his penis the night before. That she'd been trying to tear it off with her own teeth was only because of her frustration and anger at getting pregnant. Nothing to do with him, really. And it was just his bad luck that his champion was the nearest thing at hand on which to vent all her anger and whatnot.
"We could attack," suggested the Teblor in her stentorian voice. "A surprise! Can we overtake 'em?" "Teblor can, but not you. They are using the road. There is a road up there. My scout saw it, and there were soldiers on it, running."
Did your scout see the parish?
"No. Colancy soldiers on the road, running."
"Oh, my cursed gods of the Bargast, am I wallowing in the muck with you? Feels like it. With some brainless backwoods harridan for company, too. Felled any trees lately, woman?"
"What? No trees anywhere. I'd hit my head if there were trees. I'm glad there are no trees."
And she bellowed a laugh, only to then shake her head.
"Your language, it is so clumsy."
She drew a sudden deep breath, and out from her came a smooth flow of sounds Spax had not imagined possible from this Teblor.
"What was that?" he demanded when she'd finished.
"I make up poem songs in my own language. I am famous for it. Ha ha!
Care to translate what you just said?"
"No, useless. You have one word for one thought. We have many thoughts for one word. You all speak too slow, and we have to slow down too, and we get bored talking to you humans."
Gasping, Spax shook his head.
"Right now, no more words from me, at all."
"I should carry you?"
"Oh, and watch me try and live that down, in front of all my warriors? They'd die laughing, never mind enemy pikes and swords." "Don't even touch me," he growled.
The Colancy wasted little time, pouring down from the road to form up opposite the parish on the field, and then, once the shields were locked and swords drawn, they advanced, matching step by step the troops remaining on the road. Sindacan stood one row back from the front line. Much as he wanted to be with his fellow cutters amongst the buildings, he was now commanding, and his place was here with his brothers and sisters. They were still winded, their legs sagging under them. He knew the signs of muscle exhaustion, and there was no time to fully recover.
"This is going to be unpleasant."
The Colancy closed to within 6 paces and then charged. Gilimada dropped back again.
"There is fighting!"
"For Hood's sake, Teblor, we may be slow, but we're not deaf."
"Should we join them from here?"
"Not unless you want to fight on the damned slope. No, we'll move past the whole mess and come up behind the parish, and then move forward."
"But I want to kill the mixed blood."
"Maybe you'll get a chance at that."
"No, I want to kill him right away. It's important."
"Fine, you can lead a counterattack once we're up there, all right?"
Gilimada smiled broadly, her teeth even and white as snow.
"And we will cut down every tree we see."
He glared at her back as she loped ahead. His heart felt ready to burst, and he wondered if it might, the moment he stepped up to fight, a sudden clenching in his chest or whatever happened when the thing seized up. He was certain that it had hurt, probably a lot. Glancing upslope to his left, he saw rising dust, and there, the flash of spears or perhaps pikes or even swords. Ahead, the Teblor raised a shout, and Spax squinted to see bodies sliding down the slope, limbs flailing, weapons skirling away.
"Go past! Go past!"
His warriors were pressing up behind him. Spax snarled,
"Go round me then, damn you all! I'll catch up!"
They poured past on either side in a clatter of armor and drawn weapons.
"My beloved fools, all of you!"
40 more heaving paces, another 10, 5, and then, looking up, he saw his Bargast scrambling in the wake of the Teblor, up the valley side, many of them using their hands where they could, and above them the parish falling back, spinning away from blows, tumbling and skidding down into the midst of the climbing warriors.
Gods curse us all. Climb! Get up there!
He saw the Teblor reach the summit, saw them plunge forward and out of sight, weapons swinging. And then, behind them, the first of the Gilk, armor grey with dust, their white faces running with stained sweat. Spax reached the base, clambered upward. His legs were half numb under him. Blisters roared with pain on his ankles, his heels. He coughed out dust, was almost knocked over by a descending corpse, a perish, most of his face cut away, and struggled yet higher.
Is there no end to this damned hillside?
And then a hand reached down, took hold of his wrist, and Spax was dragged onto level ground. They were in the midst of farm buildings, and the Colansi were on all sides, sweeping down from the road, driving the buckling clumps of perish back towards the valley edge. His first sight of this told him that the Grey Helms had been flanked, and though they fought on with a ferocity worthy of their gods, they were dying by the score. His Gilk had slammed into this press, but even as they did so, more Colansi surged forward, fully encircling the defenders, with the valley side the only possible retreat. Dark fury raged in Spax as he staggered forward, readying his weapons.
We failed, Firehair. May all the swamp gods rot in Hood's own bog. We should have set out earlier. We should have marched with the perish.
The Teblor had formed a solid square and were pushing through the enemy, but even they were not enough. On the road, Spax could see massive elements of the Colansi army simply driving forward, eastward, ignoring the vicious last stand on their right.
We didn't even slow them down. Withdraw! Bargast! Perish! Teblor! Withdraw! Down the hillside! Back down the hillside!
Seeing warrior and soldier stumbling back, seeing them twist and pour down from the summit, the war chief's heart felt cold, buried in ashes.
Gessler, where your flank? We couldn't hold them. We just couldn't.
The press of retreating warriors, blooded and desperate, gathered him up, and they all slid ragged paths back down the slope. He was pulled along unresisting.
All this way, for this? We could have done more.
But he knew that any stand would have been doomed. There were just too many Colansi, and they fought with demonic valor. He had lost both his weapons on the descent, and his soul howled at the appropriateness of that. Tilting his head back, he stared up at the sun. It was barely noon. In the depths of night, rain was pouring down in Darujistan. Karsa Orlong had walked into the city, and now he stood, water streaming from him, waiting. Opposite him was the temple, and the vow that he had made so long ago now, in the savage intensity of youth, was a heat in his flesh, so fierce that he thought he could see steam rising from his limbs. Almost time. He'd seen no one else in the street since dusk, and during the day, while he had stood in place, the people of this city had swept past, unwilling to fix eyes upon him for very long. A troop of city guards had lingered for a time, nervous, half circling his position where he had stood, his huge stone sword resting point down, his hands wrapped about its leather-bound grip. Then they had simply moved on. He would have been irritated at having to kill them, and no doubt there would have been alarms, and yet more guards and more killing. But rather than being heaped with the dead, the cobbled width of the street before him remained unobstructed. Eyes half closed, he experienced again the echo of the life he had watched seething back and forth in the day now gone. He wondered at all those lives, the way few would meet the gazes of their fellows, as if crowds demanded willful anonymity, when the truth was they were all in it together. All these people facing much the same struggles, the same fears. And yet, it seemed, each one was determined to survive them alone, or with but a few kin and friends offering paltry allegiance. Perhaps they each believed themselves unique, like a knotstone in the center of the world's mill wheel. But the truth was, there were very few who could truly make claim to such a pivotal existence. After all, there was only one Carsa Orlong. Standing here across from a modest temple with stained walls and faded friezes, standing here with the fate of the world in his hands. He had known a time in chains. He had lived in that wretched house, his hands closed into fists against the slavery in which so many insisted he reside, meek, uncomplaining, accepting of his fate. He thought back to the citizens he'd seen here. So many had been dragging chains. So many had walked bowed and twisted by their weight. So many had, with their own hands, hammered tight the shackles, believing that this was how it was supposed to be. Sweating at another person's behest, the muscles and will given away and now owned by someone claiming to be their better in all things. Year after year, a lifetime of enslavement. This was the conversation of the civilized, and it repulsed Carsa Orlong to the very core of his being. Who was the slave master? Nothing but a host of cruel ideas, nothing but a deceitful argument. A sleight-of-hand deception between things of value, where one wins and the other always loses. He had heard bartering, had witnessed bargains made, and it all had the illusion of fairness, and it all played out as if it was a ritual deemed necessary, made iron like a natural law. But where was the joy in that ceaseless struggle? Where was the proper indolence of the predator? And just how many fangs needed pulling to make this precious civilization? Of course, not everyone suffered the same emasculation, and this was where all the lies finally gathered. The hungriest maws, fangs dripping, hid in the cool upper rooms of the estates in the fountained gardens of the rich. And these ones, oh, they indulged all the indolence they desired, while the crowds of their lessers looked on, wide-eyed and ever eager for details. A broken and suffering god in chains had haunted him. It had flung weapons in his path. It had whispered all manner of enticements. It had, in all its desperate pain, rushed down 1,000 tracks, only to find not a moment of blessed relief. Carsa now understood that god. The times that he had been chained, he had felt that terrible panic, that animal frenzy to escape. No mortal, human or Toblachai, should ever feel such feelings. Nor, he knew now, should a god.
"He cannot know compassion from whom compassion has been taken. He cannot know love with love denied him. But he will know pain when pain is all that is given him."
Compassion, love. It was not civilization that birthed these gentle gifts, though its followers might claim otherwise. Nor was civilization the sweetest garden for such things to blossom in, though those trapped within it might imagine it so. No, as far as he could see, civilization was a madman's mechanism that, for all its good intentions, ended up ensnaring the gentle gifts, stifling them, leaving them to wander mazes only to die alone and in the dark. A mechanism, a cage work, and in its chaos the slaves bred like flies, until the world itself groaned under the assault of their appetites.
"You have made many vows, Carsa Orlong."
A civilization was the means by which too many people could live together despite their mutual hatred. And those moments where love and community burgeoned forth, the cynics descended like vultures eager to feed, and the skies soured and the moment died away.
"Upon my heart, Carsa Orlong, do you hear me? Upon my heart."
Blinking, Carsa looked down to see a crippled man drawn up against his feet. The rain streamed around him, gushed and swirled, and the face that had twisted up to look at him seemed to be shedding from blinded eyes the tears of the world.
"Is it time, then?"
Carsa demanded.
"Will you kill it all?"
The Toblachai showed his teeth.
"If I can." "It will simply grow up again, like a weed from the ashes. For all that we are made to kneel, Carsa Orlong,
we yearn to fly.
Yes, rare and noble and precious as pigeons. I've seen the statues of old heroes in the square, old man. I've seen their crowns of bird shit.
I was an artist once. These hands, so deformed now, so bent and frozen. And you understand? All this talent, but no way to release it, no way to give it shape. But perhaps we are all like that, and only the lucky few are able to find talent's path unbarred.
I doubt it, Kasa replied. Thunder rumbled from beyond the lake. The crippled man coughed.
I am drowning. I have enjoyed our conversation on the merits of the civilized, Kasa Oolong. But now I must surrender. I must die. Sick, fevered. The needs burn too hot. I have given you the words you shall use. Upon my heart. Upon my heart.
Kasa stared at the wretched shape at his feet. He set his sword to lean against the wall behind him and then crouched down. The crippled man's face lifted, the sightless eyes white as polished coins.
What are you doing?
Kasa reached down, gathered the skeletal figure into his arms, and then settled back.
I stepped over corpses on the way here, the Toblakai said. People no one cared about, dying alone. In my barbaric village this would never happen. But here in this city, this civilized jewel, it happens all the time.
The ravaged face was turned upward, the last of the raindrops dripping away as he huddled beneath the cover Kasa provided. The mouth worked, but no sounds came forth.
What is your name? Kasa asked.
Moonug.
Moonug. This night, before I must rise and walk into the temple, I am a village, and you are here in my arms. You will not die uncared for.
You would do this for me, a stranger?
In my village, no one is a stranger, and this is what civilization has turned its back on. One day, Moonug, I will make a world of villages, and the age of cities will be over, and slavery will be dead, and there shall be no chains. Tell your god. Tonight I am his knight.
Moonug's shivering was fading. The old man smiled.
He knows.
It wasn't too much to take a frail figure into one's arms for those last moments of life. Better than a cot or even a bed in a room filled with loved ones. Better, too, than an empty street in the cold rain. To die in someone's arms, could there be anything more forgiving? Every savage barbarian in the world knew the truth of this. Behind their massive shields, the Vagath soldiers of the Kachin Chemal advanced into a hailstorm of arrows and heavy quarrels. Impacts staggered some of them, quarrels shattering against the shields. Others reeled, heads, necks, and chests sprouting shafts, and as they fell, their kin moved up to take their places, and the reptilian assault drew ever closer to the trenches and redoubts. In the center of the advance, the Tlani Mas weathered a similar deluge of missile fire. But they held no shields, and where the oversized quarrels struck, the bodies shattered, bones exploding into shards and splinters. Those that could then picked themselves back up and continued on, but many were too broken to rise again, lying amid the wreckage of their own bones. The withering fusillade lashed into the attacking forces again and again. Scores of Vigath went down, legs kicking, tails whipping or striking the ground. Deep gaps opened in the Tlani Mas lines, yet there were no screams, no terrible cries of agony or horror. Sister Reverence stood high above the battle, winds both hot and bitter cold whipping about her, and watched as the enemy forces pushed ever closer to her soldiers waiting in their trenches and raised redoubts. The sorcery of Akrast Corvalane streaming from her
She held fast her Kalansi heavy infantry, leaving no room for fear, and she could feel them bristling as she fed them her hunger.
"Do not yield! Slay them all! Do not yield!"
They would hold. They had to. And then high-watered Festian would arrive to strike at the Kachane flank, driving deep a mortal wound against these hated enemies of old. She swore under her breath upon seeing masses of Kel hunters break out along the high rock-studded sides, rushing the fortified Onager positions, and she watched as the crews frantically swung the heavy weapons round. They managed a single salvo, the scores of quarrels tearing into the ranks of hunters, before the rest reached the base of the hill and swarmed upward, their terrible swords lifting high. As the helpless crews were slaughtered, their machines smashed into splinters, Sister Reverence dismissed the scene from her mind. She had seen 10 or more Kel hunters go down, and if each fortlet could match or better that toll, then she was satisfied. She would rely on attrition. There was no other choice. Now that the battle was underway, her panic had subsided. Though the murder of Brother Diligence still sent trembling waves of shock through her, she remained uncertain as to the manner of his death, and that still disturbed her. If she gave her dread free rein, she knew her fear would return. Humans were duplicitous and brazen. They should have known better than to underestimate their treacherous, deceitful natures. His power had been turned back upon him, somehow. He had drowned in a deluge of words, and she could not comprehend how that was even possible. But in this battle below, she could see but two humans.
"Riding Vergath by the Abyss. Do they command? No, that cannot be. The Kachane Chemal would never yield to human rule. They are ever commanded by their matron and none other. It has always been so, and so it remains. A formidable matron, however, to have spawned so many Vergath. She stays hidden. She evades my questing. That alone speaks of impressive power. But when this is done, when her army is destroyed, I will find her. I will eviscerate her. This day is the last gasp of the Kachane Chemal. There are no other matrons left. I am certain of it. They must have discovered the alliance I made with the Naruk, and so they have come here seeking vengeance. Am I a child with a hand to be slapped? Of the four ancient races, who was always the most feared, if not the Fokrul Asael?
She knew there were other Pures on distant continents, and once Akrast Kor Valain's power was made unassailable in this place, she would quest to find them. She would invite them to share in this power, and the cleansing could begin in earnest.
"We shall unleash such justice as to—"
A frigid blast of air swept up around her, and Sister Reverence turned from the battle below. Facing into that icy wind, she made her way across the platform to the side, looking out over the sea. What she saw stunned her. Kolant's Bay was filling with ice. Mountains, glowing emerald and sapphire, were rising up from the depths, and as she stared, she saw the churning water bleach white, saw every wave freeze solid. The perished ships, which had been broken and smashed and swallowed by the sea, had now reappeared, the wreckage sealed in ice. And there were more ships, ones long buried in the silts of the sea bottom, heaving to the surface. Directly below, the sheltered Kolansi galleys and triremes, now locked in ice, began to shatter, hulls collapsing. The sound of that destruction, rising up to where she stood, was a chorus of detonations, as of trees battered down by winds. The entire bay was now solid ice, the surface a crazed landscape of jagged translucent crags, welling fissures and flat sweeps of dirty snow. Mists poured from it in roiling clouds. And, with the voice of grinding mountains, it had begun lifting higher, tilting, the nearest end reaching upwards. The mole and breakwaters of the harbour directly below were suddenly obliterated, torn and crushed to rubble. And as the ice shifted, Reaching the base of the spire, Sister Reverence felt the stone tremble beneath her feet.
"This cannot be! Omtos Felak, what Jaghut dares this? No, they are gods!"